Great big thanks to Steve Pallett and Jody Peterson for agreeing to this interview. Steve will do a fine job as always. And I think Jody has a great story to tell. I know I'm looking forward to it. And thank you for coordinating the recordings there. Mike or Speed Bump has agreed to take over the role of this event as our coordinator, and I think he's going to do a fantastic job. Steve, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, and welcome everyone to Spotlight. And it's my pleasure once more to interview one of our FTP friends. And as Jennifer said, this time it's Jody Peterson, and we're going to have a really interesting chat with Jody. Jody, can I begin, as always, by asking you where and when you were born?
Well, I was born and I grew up in southern Illinois, which is about 2.5 hours out of St. Louis, Missouri, on the Illinois side, all the way down by the Mississippi River, a very small town called Dongola, Illinois. So I grew up probably 20, 25 miles off of the Mississippi River, so saw a lot of time on the water there. And that's where I spent most of my time growing up.
Can you tell me a little bit about your parents, mom and dad? What did they do?
My parents both worked all the time as I was growing up. My father, we used to tease him that he was Fred Flintstone because he worked at a limestone rock quarry, and he does heavy equipment, drives a bulldozer and a loader and all the heavy equipment type things. My mother actually has had a couple of different careers. She spent most of her time as a loan officer at our local bank in town, and now she actually is the city clerk for the village itself. So the town I grew up in only had a population of about 900 people, so it was very small.
Pretty rural by the sound of it. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers. I have a brother that's a year older than me, and I have a younger brother who's 5 years younger than me who also comes on the site here. My younger brother is Kimchi Head, if anybody has seen him online or at the card tables on All in Play. He's my younger brother. And then we have an adopted brother who is a year older than my oldest brother, and he has a wife and 5 children, so he's got his hands full too.
Yeah, it sounds as if he has, Jody. Can we just go back to the area you grew up in and give us a flavour of what sort of community it was? You said it was only about 900. Just give us a brief outline of the area itself, what it was like.
I grew up in your stereotypical small one-street village, you know, one-stop sign, one main street through town. We had 2 gas stations. We had 2 small cafes. We had a bank. We had a drugstore. We had about 7 churches. 1 school, which housed all the way from kindergarten through high school. So, and that's where I went to school. I did all my schooling there. You know, a very small rural country village.
And what do you remember doing as a small child? Were you out and about in the area getting into all sorts of scrapes as a small kid?
Well, when I was younger, we never lived right in the middle of town. We kind of lived out in the country, and my grandparents had a farm, so we spent a lot of time on the farm with my grandparents, helping my grandfather do things, working with the cattle. We raised beef cattle. So growing up, you spent a lot of time with the animals. We always had dogs and cats and several different pets growing up. But a lot of my younger years, you know, we spent with them. As I got further along in school, you know, spent a lot more time with my friends and such. But most of my time was spent on the farm as a young child.
It sounds lovely. It sounds idyllic. Very, very rural and very pleasant, I should think. Can we learn just a little bit about your eye condition? I want to talk in more detail about your eye condition a little later in the interview, Jody, but have you always had a problem with your eyesight?
Yes, I was born with my condition. My younger brother, Tim Sheehan, also has the same eye condition that I do, so there are actually two of us in the family who have limited vision. I do have some vision, not a lot, but enough to actually use it for some things. I don't have a guide dog, and I don't walk with a cane, although I probably should. I've been this way since birth.
And it's probably a difficult question to ask someone who's partially sighted because you've got no reference point, but how much vision have you got? Has anyone actually quantified it and said, well, you know, it's such and such? How much vision do you have?
As far as numbers go, I think that almost every time I was tested, they got a different number, so I don't know that it's very valid. If I were guessing, I would have to say somewhere in the range of, you know, 2,600 or 2,500. And that is very dependent on the amount of light. Because I have a retina disorder, it's totally dependent on how much light's on the subject that I'm looking at. So it very much varies.
That's understood. Now, you mentioned a few minutes back that you did all your schooling in your town. And I take it then that that was not a residential school, that was a mainstream school. And how did you cope at school?
Well, my parents, as probably a lot of parents do who don't have a lot of education and training on how to deal with a blind child or whatever, they wanted to do whatever they could to make sure that I fit in with the rest of the kids in town. They didn't want me to have to go to a special school. They really didn't want to accept the fact that I was, you know, that I had a condition or whatnot. So what they wanted to do was is they wanted to try to see if I could handle going to the public school and not have to do anything, you know, go to a special school. So when it came time for kindergarten when I was five, you know, they sent me to school with the rest of the children, and I was able to do okay, actually. As a young child, obviously I wasn't afraid of anything, you know, because you just don't know any better. So in the younger years of school, they provided a teacher's assistant that would sit kind of by me in class and tell me, you know, what they were writing on the board, on the chalkboard or whatnot, so that, you know, I didn't miss out on what the teacher was doing. And then the teachers were also very acceptant and would help me, you know, if with anything special that I might have needed. But because it was such a small town and such a small school, my class that I graduated with, even from high school, only had 35 people in it. So it was, you could get the one-on-one help that you needed. I probably couldn't have done that in a large school, but I think I was pretty lucky growing up where I did.
Were you probably the only pupil with a physical disability then? Is that pretty fair to say? Was there anyone else in any way in a similar situation to yourself?
No, there wasn't, except for my younger brother. Once he got into school, we were the only two all throughout my whole, underschooling that had any condition like that. But really, you know, because we went to school with pretty much the same kids all through school, you know, they were very accepting, and they knew what our situation was, and they didn't really treat us any differently than anybody else. So it really, you know, I never had to deal with any odd situations. You know, everybody was helpful. So, you know, I think it worked out real well.
Yeah, I should think it did. I mean, obviously, you grew up with the kids that you started with, and you probably know some of them to this day. Although you don't live there anymore, of course, but you probably still keep in touch with some of the friends you made in those days. What were your favorite subjects at school? What did you excel in?
I probably liked the sciences. I did not like math, and I did not do real well in math. I did enjoy sciences, chemistry, and physics, and you know, doing the labs and experiments and things like that. Probably more than anything. I really wasn't a history buff back then, although I am more of one now. Probably mechanical things and the sciences.
Would you say that you did well at school? I mean, were you academically good? Did you come away with lots of exams and stuff?
I would say that in my younger years, until I got in junior high school, when you learn how to goof off and cause trouble, that I did real well. Once I got to that age where I was a little bit more rebellious and such, I would say that my focus shifted from my studies, and it probably shouldn't have. And I didn't get as good of grades. I think I had, you know, just like my parents would say, I had the potential, I just didn't use it during those years. So, I did okay, in high school, although I could have done better. And once I went off to college, I really applied myself and did much better, you know, when I went to college, because I realized that it was something that was a lot more important than I previously had thought it was.
What career plans had you got for yourself just as you were leaving school?
Well, when I got into high school, this was you know, early 80s. So the computer age was just really starting to really get going, and when our school got our first computers, you know, a lot of us really took to them and really enjoyed them and wanted to learn more about them. And I think I knew fairly early on that a career in the computer field of some sort was what I wanted to do, for the main reason of it didn't seem to slow me down like other things did. You know, there's a lot of career choices. You know, I couldn't join the military. I couldn't drive a vehicle, so I couldn't be airplane pilot or bus driver or things like that. So I had to find a career that would work well for me. And I liked the technical side of things, so the computer area, I pretty much knew right away that that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I followed through with.
Where did you go to pursue this then, Jody, after school? What happened then?
I went to the university. I have a four-year bachelor's degree. I went to school at Southern Illinois University. Those basketball fans out there will know that our school actually has made it to the NCAA tournament the past few years. That university is only probably 35 or 40 miles from my hometown, so even though I moved away from home, it wasn't very far, it wasn't that far. I did live away at school for college. I got a computer degree. I have a four-year computer information systems degree that I got from that university. One of the reasons I chose that school was because they have a very dedicated office for what they call Disabled Student Services, and they may have changed the name now to maybe be more politically correct or whatnot, but then they had an office that specialized in helping folks with all kinds of different disabilities with the university. They were one of the top schools in the country as far as everything being accessible, both wheelchair accessible and, you know, blind accessible. They had Braille numbers on all the room numbers for the classrooms, so you could find where you were going. They had the Disabled Student Services had a test proctoring service, so if you needed someone, they provided readers and note takers. They ordered all of your textbooks for you. Really anything you could possibly need, they provided. It was a very, very good school to go to, and I would highly recommend it to anybody looking for a place to go to college.
It sounds like they make a real effort to help people with you know, disabilities in that environment. We're probably talking, what are we talking, mid-80s by now, Jody, and I'm just wondering if they had any specialist assistive technology there in the form of early speech systems, etc., or was that still a little way in the future?
Probably still a little bit out. At that time, when I went to school, I didn't use any speech technology for the computer. I did have like some large screen, large type screen is what I tried to use in college, because they didn't have the speech stuff as much out then. They did have an output Braille terminal, so folks that were learning how to, that did do Braille, they did have a Braille printer and a Braille output terminal on one of the machines. They had a CCTV in the library that I actually used quite a bit to study. You know, a special area in the library that you could go to study and you know, use the CCTV or listen to your talking books and stuff. You know, things like that they did have.
Well, it seems they made a real effort, and obviously you took full advantage of the facilities that they offered to you. So you obviously spent the time at college and you got your degree. What was your next step after graduating?
Well, time-wise, we're talking, I started college in 1987, and I graduated in December of 1990. My last semester at school, it was time to figure out, you know, how we were going to get a job and you know, what was next after college for college.
I'm sorry, Joe, I'm not sure what happened there. There's a big pause. Can you just recap just a little bit for us?
I'm sorry, I must have lost the key. I graduated in December of 1990, and like I say, that last semester of school is when I really tried to determine, you know, it was basically looking at all the major computer companies out there and trying to find a job. Is you know, we shot out a lot of resumes, and a lot of companies came on campus recruiting, and that's basically how I got my job that I still have to this day.
Okay, and where did you end up working? Who did you work for after leaving college?
I worked for a company called Electronic Data Systems, EDS, and they have offices located really all over the world. They were on campus recruiting at the time, and unfortunately, during their on-campus interviews, those interview slots filled up so quick that I wasn't able to snag one of the interview slots on campus at that time. So what I did was, one of my friends who did get an interview, I got the name of the recruiter and an address, and I sent a cover letter and resume to them directly, and ended up doing some phone interviewing with them, you know, over the phone is kind of how I got started. And then, of course, you know, that process went on. I eventually ended up getting hired.
What actually is your job title? What, if someone asked you what you did, what would you say? What is your job description?
Well, like I said, I've worked at this company for almost 14 years now, so I've had several different titles, I guess you could say, through the years. When I first hired in, the way that they brought people in from college was they brought them into their continuing development program. It was called the Systems Engineering Development Program, and that's like a 3-year program where the first year of that program you work on a customer account, and you normally wouldn't do much computer programming. You would generally do help desk support, or you would help write technical manuals and help the other engineers with their projects, but you really wouldn't be fully responsible for any projects on your own. And you do that for a year. Then they send you off to 3 months of intense programming training, and that's where they kind of weed out the people who they think, you know, are really good, competent programmers, and then the other people kind of have to find a new job. If you make it through that, then the third phase is you are a, you know, full-blown programmer, and you get programming assignments and things like that. I went through that program, so I was a programmer for several years, both on the mainframe and on the personal computer level. What I ended up doing as the computer age went to more visual things, you know, with Windows and such, is I decided that, well, designing screen layouts and choosing colors and stuff really, for me, isn't the best, I'm not really the best suited for that. So I started learning more of the networking side of things and the database area. And what I do now and what I've done for the past 5 or 6 years is I'm a database administrator. So I manage network servers and make sure that the applications that other programmers write can connect to my databases and get data out of my databases. And that's the main thing that I do right now.
So you're a database administrator, is that correct?
Yes, I'm a network engineer and a database administrator. I kind of have dual roles right now.
Okay, can you just give us a run through a typical day at work for yourself, Jody? Just walk us through a typical day in your life.
Okay, right now my day starts at probably 5 o'clock to 5:30 a.m. We have to get the kids up. And I have to get the kids ready to get out the door with Mama when she goes to work so they can go to daycare. I currently work from home, which I started about 3 or 4 years ago. And so once we get them out the door, then I can kind of start my work day. And what I generally do is I start by logging into my work system, which runs through what they call a VPN or a virtual private network. So through the Internet, I can access my corporate network. So I log onto the corporate network. I check reports. I have diagnostic reports that run every morning and show me the status of all the servers that I support. I have probably 80 or 90 servers really spread all over the world that house these databases. So they each report back. So I get an email every morning from my application that says, okay, here's all your servers and here's the tasks that failed last night, and here's the ones that ran successful, here's the status of your servers. So if there are issues, I go out and look at them and try to resolve them. Once I get my morning, work done basically, then I usually have several conference calls during the day, which involve usually the design of new systems or a particular project that's going on where they're trying to sell some business or build a new database for someone. So I spend a lot of time in meetings doing consulting and such. I work directly with the programmers to make sure that the applications that they write are written efficiently to access the data as quick as possible and troubleshoot things like that. So that's the majority of my day is spent doing those things. And then I do diagnostic reports again at the end of the day, before quitting time. I also carry a cell phone which has text messaging on it. So if any of my servers has a problem during the day, they will automatically page me and say, hey, I'm having a problem, and then I'll go in and look at that. I also get calls from the help desk when they have issues. So I keep pretty busy during the day. But the good thing about it is that my corporate network doesn't block for the people. So I do tend to sneak out here every once in a while and talk to folks during the day, even while I'm working.
And why not? Now, you said that you had all these servers to maintain. So if there's a problem with one of them, you've got the means to fix it remotely. You've got diagnostic tools there which enable you to correct any problem. Bit of a naive question from a non-techie person, but does that mean your workspace is full of hardware and stuff, or is it all basically software which cures all these problems? Or are you sitting in front of a rack of machines? That's basically what I'm asking you.
No, I don't personally sit in front of a rack of machines. There is a rack of machines at each of the locations that you know where these things sit, but I access them across the Internet remotely, and I can reboot those machines remotely. I can install software, remove software, basically take over the keyboard on the remote machine from my machine. So I don't have to have a rack of servers sitting in front of me. I do probably have three computers here that I use for testing and and such before I roll something out into production, but I don't have to have a lot of equipment here. I do most all my work right from my laptop.
I'm fascinated to know a little bit about the databases you maintain, because you maintain databases for commercial companies. Let me make sure I've got this right. The databases hold customer details, things like credit card details and things like that. Is that right, or am I completely wrong?
Yes, and it really depends on the customer, because I've supported several different customers in the past. When I first got into doing database work, I supported General Motors, and a lot of the work that databases that I supported related to vehicle warranties and customer vehicle purchases and orders. Actually, if someone went to their dealer and wanted to buy a vehicle or custom order a vehicle, I supported databases that actually took those orders in and sent them right off to the vehicle manufacturing plants to be built. And so I could see the schedules of when a vehicle was going to be built and all that type of information. I've since switched accounts, and now I work in the have been working with telecommunications companies, and my major customer right now is AT&T. So right now, most of the databases that I support deal with businesses and customers ordering telephone service. So they process telecommunications orders and deal with that type of information. But yes, for the most part, it's usually customer information.
Now, as someone who actually deals with maintaining these databases, how safe are they? I mean, we quite happily ring up. We do it over here in the UK as well, as people all over the world, and we quite readily give details about our personal life, credit card numbers, all sorts of personal information. How safe is it?
Well, there's several different layers of security involved before anyone could actually physically get into the database and deal with it. So there's plenty of safeguards in place. We have a private network that's separate from the public internet, which is where most, pretty basically all the information is stored. So no one else, without proper authority could get into those databases.
I suppose it's a constant battle between people who want to hack and people who want to be secure. I suppose it's a constant round of trying to be smarter than the other guy. Are there developments going on as we speak to try and make it even more secure, or is it just a never-ending battle and there always will be a way through?
I think it's probably a never-ending battle, although most, especially large corporations, have specific teams and groups that's all they do. That's their whole job, is to hunt down these possible security threats and plug the holes, basically. So, they're separate organizations that's all they do. I don't deal specifically in the security area, but I get calls from the security people warning me of possible threats and such and advising of service packs or patches or things like that to put on my servers to make sure that they stay secured.
As someone with a severe sight problem in this profession of yours, do you find it difficult to keep up with the latest developments?
In the earlier days I did, but now, even for sighted people, most of the reference material publishers and such publish their stuff electronically anyway, so that technical folks that travel can have all this material on their laptops versus having to carry stacks of reference manuals when they travel across the country. So since the advent of the e-books and the e-texts and things like that, the material has become a lot more accessible than it used to be. Used to be the paper book would come out, and it wouldn't be for several months down the road that you would be able to get an electronic version of that, and by that time sometimes this stuff's obsolete already. So, but now you don't really have that. Now you should be able to get your hands on electronic versions of any kind of reference material that you would need.
Are you at the current time working towards bettering your qualifications?
Yeah, actually, I'm currently working on a Microsoft certification right now, a Microsoft certified database administrator credential or certification, and that's a process of four exams that you have to take, and I'm currently getting ready to set for one of them right now. If you pass all four of those exams, you get their certified credential, and you put at the end of your name just like a title or, you know, whatnot. And in the computer industry, those certifications seem to be becoming more and more prevalent. Lots of employers almost require that anymore. It doesn't seem like a computer degree in itself is good enough that you really have to carry these certifications in order to really prove yourself to the companies. The job market is so tough right now that they really weed out just the top candidates for positions. So in order to really stay ahead of the game, it's important that you do those things. I'm personally not a real big proponent of exams as being a true guide as to how talented you are, but I'm kind of forced into the with everybody else into taking these exams, so that's kind of where we stand on that.
Would the certification, when you get it, which I'm sure you will this enable you to go forward into other fields?
It will open the door to more and more job possibilities, because what you see is that when project postings come out for new projects, they'll say, okay, I need four people. I need three programmers and a database administrator. All of them have to be certified or we won't even talk to you, basically. So it really will just open the door to more job opportunities.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from there, Jody. When you first decided to go into this field, did you find, as a person with a severe sight problem, that you came across any prejudice from potential employers when they discovered that you had this problem with your eyesight?
Well, I'll say that when I kind of struggled at the as I was starting to do my resumes to interview for companies as to what should I really do? Should I put right on my resume, oh, by the way, I'm blind and, you know, I'll need special accommodations or this and that. And I spoke to several different people about it as to whether or not I should do that. And what it came down to was I did not even end up putting that on my resume because I really didn't want to point that out to anybody to be, to be shot down or thrown out of the mix. I wanted to be able to talk to someone face-to-face in an interview before they really knew what that particular situation was, because honestly, it shouldn't impact your job performance anyway. So it really shouldn't be an issue to an employer other than the fact of knowing that if you need them to buy equipment for you or something like that. So when I went through the interview process, the lady that was interviewing me didn't know I had a sight problem at all until we scheduled the formal interview. And the reason that she knew then is because they flew me out of town. I had to fly to Green Bay, Wisconsin for this interview, and I needed to make sure that I had the proper transportation because I couldn't rent a car and drive, and I was traveling by myself, so I had to make sure that I had the proper arrangements. I think she was very nervous at first, but once that she really got to know me things seemed to fall into place. And then once I actually got in, you know, with the company and stuff, the account supervisors and people like that have always been very good. I've never run into any issues as far as somebody not wanting to work with me because of my situation or anything like that. I've always been pretty lucky, I think.
Do you think it's up to the candidate to put over the correct image in an interview situation, sighted or not?
Oh, I definitely believe that. I think that that's one of the most important things that anyone, sighted or not, can do in an interview is be positive. you know, if you come into a job interview, no matter what kind of position it's for, and you come in and express to the person who's interviewing you all the things that you're not able to do, I'll guarantee you that 100% of the time you will not get that position. You have to come into an interview situation and express the things that you can do. You know, how can you make that company better? How can you, what skills do you bring to the table? Because it's not that company's job to hold your hand and do everything for you. It's your job to do a job for them. So you need to come in and express to that company all the things that you can do, not the things that you can't do. Unless you're asked specific questions of you know, what you have issues with. I mean, obviously, you know, there could be some issues, but you definitely don't want to have that be the forefront of your conversation during an interview. And that's the same with sighted or non-sighted people. I've had team leader positions where I interviewed people for jobs before, and I had people come in and go, oh, you know, I don't know how to do this, or I can't do that, or blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's a very big no-no in an interview. You just can't do that.
Jody, you told us a few minutes ago that you worked from home. Do any of your colleagues work from home, or do they go to an office somewhere?
Like I say, I've only worked from home for the past 3 or 4 years. I was in the office, you know, all the time previous to that. But most, especially large corporations, depending on what your job responsibilities are a lot more open to people working from home now with the advent of all the communications technologies, with the internet and with private networks and security, that it's actually able to do that. So the group that I actually work in has my small team. I believe we have 6 people in Pennsylvania, all in the office. I have 2 people in Raleigh, North Carolina that also work in an office down there. I have a guy that works from home in Biloxi, Mississippi. I have 3 guys from India that work in Mumbai, India. I have 2 folks up in Sydney, Nova Scotia, in Canada. And I have some folks in Tucson, Arizona that work from home, and some folks in Boise, Idaho who work from home. So we actually have people spread all over the country, and actually all over the world, and some work from home, some work in the office, but we have conference calls where we all come together and have team meetings and such, just like you would if everyone were in the same place. So I don't really feel like I lose anything by working from home. Some people say that they feel like they might lose the social aspect of the office and this and that, and I really don't feel like that because I talk to so many people during the day through, you know, the communications that I have to do for work. I don't feel like I lose any of the social aspect of the office. In fact, I probably get more work done because I don't have people bugging me unless they need something.
Is it difficult to discipline yourself working at home? Do you lock yourself in your office at start time and come out at end time? Is it difficult, especially if you've got other distractions, or do you have to be very, very focused?
Well, what I found was, and I was kind of worried about that, and that's one of the reasons that some people don't want to work from home because they don't think they can be disciplined. And I find that my job keeps me busy enough that that I don't have to worry about it because there's so many things to be done and there's a schedule to be kept anyway. So I don't, if I do have extra time, yeah, I can go throw a load of laundry in for my wife, or take the dishes out of the dishwasher or whatnot. But, you know, the bottom line is, and I've always felt like this, is that it's not as important as how many hours you spend working. It's important as to how much work you get done. Results are really what counts, because obviously there are some tasks, there are some jobs that one person, it might take 3 hours to do, and another person might be able to do it in an hour. But bottom line is it all comes down to the work getting done. So rather I spend, I might work 7 hours instead of 8 hours one day, but one day I might work 12 hours because we had a problem with the server or something that kept me going. So I don't concentrate myself quite as much on the time aspect of it as the fact of the work getting done. And to me, that's the way the business culture should be. It should be based on the work getting done, not really the time spent doing it.
Can we just now take you away from work and find out a little more about Jody the man? We know you're married. We've heard the children in the background a little while ago. Can you tell us where you met your wife?
Yeah, actually, I met my wife back in 97, I think it was. I was with some friends, and we were... my wife is from a town about 3 hours north of where I live here in Michigan, some friends and I were up north in a resort, ski resort type area, and that's where she's from. And we met at one of the resorts up there, just by accident, really. And we just got to know each other and exchanged phone numbers and started talking on the phone. And then, she came to visit a few times down where I live and such. And, that's kind of how it all got started. We got married in Las Vegas, 2001 we actually had an Elvis impersonator and the whole works. Our families got to come with us. It was kind of funny, actually. That's where that came from. And, a year later we had our first little girl. She's two now, Valerie, and she just went up to take a nap. And then my youngest little girl is 3 months old now, and her name is Alyssa.
That's lovely. And what's your wife's name?
My wife's name is Cherie. Her family is French-Canadian. They're a combination of French-Canadian and Finnish.
And hi to Cherie. I think Cherie's probably in the background there listening to your interview and thinking what a great guy you are, which of course you are. Tell us about your marriage in Las Vegas. That sounds very exotic to someone sitting over here where I am. Tell us about that.
Well, we wanted to, we had first decided, my wife wanted to have the big traditional wedding with lots of, with all the families and everything. And there was so much going on at the time that we decided, instead of having a big wedding and spending a lot of money on it, why didn't we just take our immediate families? We took my parents and we took her mother, her father's passed on, but we took her mother and her sisters. It's like, let's just take a small group of us and we'll go to Las Vegas and have a good time, make a long weekend of it, and we'll do it that way. And then whenever, later on that year, we'll have receptions for each of the families, because our families are from different states. We'll have different receptions and do it that way, so the people that couldn't come to Las Vegas with us would get to celebrate with us as well. So we went to Las Vegas. We spent, this was on Valentine's Day. This was Valentine's Day, 01. So we flew out there, at 7 a.m. We were to arrive in Vegas, I think at 8 or 9 a.m. Vegas time. We had to go directly to the, courthouse to get the marriage license and stand in line with all these other people, because everybody wants to get married on Valentine's Day in Las Vegas. So it was a long line. We stood in line for a couple hours before we got were able to get our marriage license. And it was kind of funny because, this is the courthouse in Las Vegas. So you got one line over here of people getting divorced, and you got another line over here with people getting married. And then the people who have court dates for criminal trials have to go through the middle and go through the metal detectors into court. So you saw the whole gamut of society in these lines. It was kind of funny. But we got our marriage license. Then we went, checked into our hotel. Then we had to go for fittings for the tux and the dress, because my wife actually rented her wedding dress, which in Vegas you can do anything. You can rent anything in Vegas. So my wife actually rented her wedding dress, and I rented my tux from the same place. Now we had to get fitted. We were fitted in the mornings. The alterations were made in the afternoon, and we picked the the dress and the tux up just in time to get dressed for the wedding. We got married at 9 o'clock at night. So, you know, we did these fittings, and my wife had to get her hair done, and we had to get all these things. It was a whirlwind long day, Valentine's Day. When we got everything ready, the limousines took us to the chapel. We got married at one of the wedding chapels there in Vegas, and they set the families down, and they did the wedding march, and the priest spoke a little while, and then he introduced his special guest, which was one of the best Elvis impersonators in Vegas, who came out and sang two songs, and he was dancing with with my wife's maid of honor, and it was very interesting. I don't think my wife's mother probably thought that thought it was totally appropriate, but actually I thought it was kind of fun. We had a great time. Have the whole thing on video. One of these days, if you want to hear the audio from it, I'll have to dub the audio out and let you listen to it, because it is kind of fun. Then we had the rest of the weekend to enjoy ourselves. After the wedding, we went back and had a room at the hotel. We stayed at the Excalibur, which is, if you're familiar with Las Vegas, that's the one that's the medieval castle. We had cake and ice cream and stuff that evening, and then had the rest of the weekend to enjoy ourselves in Las Vegas, which we did. We had a great time. So all in all, I thought it was very successful. We had a great time.
That sounds absolutely marvelous. Goodness me. Very lavish. It sounds really, really enjoyable. And, I'm absolutely speechless. You must have had a fantastic time out there. I know from speaking to you the other day when we did this pre-interview chat that you just moved house as well, haven't you? How did that go?
Yes, we did. We have been attempting to sell our previous home for a while now, and we finally got a buyer, and we worked through, and we finally were able to close these transactions a week or so ago, and we've actually all of last weekend. We moved, and then all the stuff that we couldn't fit in the moving trucks last weekend, we moved through the week this week. So it's been a long, huge process. We had a ton of things to move, but we finally have everything out of the old house. The new owners are already in it, and we are into our new home, and we're very happy. Very happy to be in the new home, although we're definitely still sore from moving, and now the unpacking begins. My garage is totally full of stuff that we have to unpack this weekend, or at least get moved so we can park in the garage. We're very happy with our new house. It's really nice.
Have you got your workspace sorted, or is it full of cardboard boxes?
Yeah, I do have an office in the new house. I have a den with nice hardwood floors, and the home has a two-way fireplace, so the one side of the fireplace points into the family room, and then the other side points into my office. So actually I'm going to get a new desk. My old desk was about to fall apart anyway, so we didn't even move it to the new house. So I'm waiting to get a new desk before I set all of my work area up. But I have my laptop, so I just take it out in the great room and sit in my recliner and work from there. That was just my favorite spot anyway.
Yeah, I meant to ask you just a few minutes back, Jody, about Cherie. I presume she's sighted, is she?
Yes, she is.
And the children, are they fully sighted?
Yes, they are. We took Valerie to the ophthalmologist when she was 6 months old to have her checked out, just to be sure that I couldn't have passed on any of my condition. But she's fine, and we believe that the new baby is too. And when she's old enough, we'll have her looked at as well.
And that leads us nicely on to your eye condition, and I did say pretty near the beginning of the interview that I would return to this subject later on, and now's the time. Very, very interesting what you were telling me the other day. What actually is your eye condition, and tell us a little about the research you've been involved with?
For my eye condition, the closest diagnosis that they could come was that it's a very somewhat rare form of Leber's, which some of you folks have probably heard of. It's a retina disorder where the optic cells are die off at a very rapid rate at a very young, very soon after birth, because they don't have the vitamin A that they need to live. Your optic cells use a specific form of vitamin A to be healthy, and if they're deprived of that, then the cells die, and that's what makes you go blind. I was telling Steve in our pre-interview the other day that when I was young and growing up, you know, there really wasn't a lot of research. The doctors didn't really seem to know what caused my condition or whether I could pass it on or what, you know. They just say, well, you know, you're blind. There's nothing we can do for you. So that's pretty much all we know. And every couple of years, I would go back to St. Louis to the eye clinic there and basically get the same results. So after I got out of college and moved to Michigan, I basically had quit going altogether to the eye doctor because there didn't really seem a real need to. My condition hadn't changed significantly, though, although I believe that my eyesight has definitely deteriorated quite a bit from what it was when I was very young. But what I think it was probably 1996 or 97, probably 96, I had just kind of decided on my own one day that, well, maybe I should go, again, it's been several years since I've been to the eye doctor, maybe I should go and, you know, see a specialist and just see if anything technology-wise or anything has changed. So I first went to my family doctor, who referred me to their eye doctor, who referred me to another eye doctor, and eventually the guy says, well, you need to go to the Kellogg Eye Center at the University of Michigan out in Ann Arbor and see the dean of the retina research department. His name's Dr. Paul Sieving. And I got an appointment to go see Dr. Sieving and went out there, and they did a whole lot of tests on me. And after getting my family history and learning more about my condition, Dr. Sieving says, well, you know, you really make an excellent test case for a theory that my team is working on trying to prove. And what they ended up doing was they took a blood sample from me, took DNA, because they wanted to do a DNA test to see if I carried this specific gene that they feel is responsible for causing the blindness. The gene is called RPE65. It's a mutated gene that both your parents have to carry a copy of, and they have to pass it to you in order for you to get the eye condition. If you only have one copy of it, you still have good vision. If you have two copies of it, then it's bad news, and that's what myself and my younger brother have. So because I have an older brother who has good vision and my parents have good vision, but yet my younger brother and I both are blind, we made a perfect test case for what they were trying to prove for this gene. So again, what the mutated version of this gene causes is it takes the good vitamin A that your retina needs and it gets rid of it or doesn't allow your retina to use it. So then, you know, causes you to go blind. So they brought my whole family in, took blood from them, and sure enough, my dad has one copy of it, my mom has one copy of it, my older brother has one copy of it. But my younger brother and I both got both copies, and that's what caused our vision problem. So the good news is that the doctor says, well, in order for you to pass this on to your children, your wife would also have to carry it. And it's a very, very, very slim chance of that happening. So my younger brother, who also has a child, you know, they're not really worried about her vision either. So it just seems like they learn so much more than whenever I was younger as to what, you know, what can happen or what's going on there. The next step is this, like I said, I was part of this study. This was an initial study when I first got involved in this. Those studies, the findings of that study have since been published and made, you know, put out in the medical journals and all that kind of thing. And also since then, Dr. Paul Sieving has taken a promotion. He left the University of Michigan, and he's now the head of the National Eye Institute in Washington, D.C. So people who have similar type disorders can be assured that there's going to be some government money coming into research to look into these things, because that's exactly what he's all about. And he now has a big shot government position in, you know, for the National Institute of Health, with the National Eye Institute into doing these things. So I kind of feel like I know somebody important in the field. I still keep in contact with him. He calls and checks on me, and I tell him about, you know, our new addition to the family and all of that. So it is interesting. And just one more thing on this subject, that the next step is that since they feel like they proved that that's what causes this type of blindness, the next step is okay, can they develop a synthetic form of the usable vitamin A that your retina needs, so that they can, that you know, with children, when babies are born, they do a blood test, and if they seem like that, they very good chance that they could have this problem. And if they do, start treating it early with some sort of synthetic form of the vitamin A so they don't go blind. So it might actually be one step closer to prevent blindness for children with this kind of condition. For folks like me who have already gone blind, really the only thing that they can do there is either one, try to grow optic cells and find out a way to transplant them, or you know, something of that nature. But at least, you know, I never really felt growing up that I was a real part of a solution. Was more part of just a part of the problem. But now at least I feel like I'm you know, actually involved in doing some good for the community.
Absolutely fascinating. You were obviously the perfect family unit, because you know, you've got a brother with the same condition as yourself, and sighted siblings too. So you really were the perfect case study. And let's hope they manage to achieve that, and maybe in a few years' time, you say you won't get people with your eye condition becoming blind, because you in a roundabout way will have helped to find a cure. So that's really great. Leisure time, Jody. When you're away from work and all these other things that you do, what do you like to do to relax?
One of my favorite hobbies, two main ones. One of my favorite hobbies was and still is boating. I used to own a boat with a friend of mine, and we used to spend a lot of time out on the Great Lakes here in Michigan. As this is, of course, back when we were single, once we got married and this and that, those kind of times kind of go away, at least for a while. So we sold our boat because we were buying homes and doing things like that. So I don't get to do as much boating as I used to, but I really enjoy being out on the water. My other main hobby is I like to build things. I like to work with mechanical things and learn how mechanical things work. And one of the things, even as a kid, you know, I always liked toys. You know, I was always a kid that you know, liked his toys, mechanical toys especially. So I was always into remote controlled cars and airplanes and stuff like that. And they always say that you know, as a kid, you know, as you grow up, your toys just get bigger and more expensive, and that's probably true. So I actually enjoy building airplanes, remote controlled airplanes and boats and cars and things like that. So and of course the kits are a lot more advanced and stuff than they were when I was a kid. So I still kind of enjoy tinkering with those kind of things. And as I was telling you the other day, that's how I got my nickname Watch Out here from the boards. And most people know that, 'cause they always ask me, but my nickname Watch Out comes from my remote controlled hobby, 'cause I build remote control cars and such, and some of the ones that I have are actually fuel powered, you know, engine-powered machines that can run fairly fast. I have one that will that can run up to 60 miles per hour. So if it's me that's driving it, especially due to my very limited vision, you better watch out. And that's where my nickname came from.
Wow. How big are these models then, Jody?
They range. They make, they're all different sizes. The airplane that I built is probably has a 4 foot wingspan and is probably 4 feet long or so. I think it's fuel powered. Actually, a friend of mine that I met actually flies it. I built it, and I like to do the mechanic work on it, but he flies it. I've been trying to get my wife to learn how to fly it, you know, so it doesn't spend so much time sitting in the basement versus actually being getting used. But I think she's a little bit afraid to fly it. She thinks she's going to crash it. So that's the airplane. The vehicles are all done based on scale, as far as what size they are in proportion to their full size counterparts. So I have two vehicles that are one-tenth scale, so they're one-tenth the size of their full-size counterparts. So the trucks are probably, 20 inches long, not quite 2 feet long, and 10 to 12 inches high. They're actually pretty sizable. I mean, it's not something you can drive around the house. It has to be outdoors. You need some room to be able to do it. And like I say, they make them all different scales depending on what your skill and expertise are as far as building and also as far as how much money you've got to spend on a model, because some of them are pretty expensive.
The aeroplane, I'm fascinated by the aeroplane. Is it radio controlled? Do you have a radio control unit in your hand, or is it attached by a wire, or is it completely free to fly wherever it's piloted?
It's completely free to fly. It's radio controlled. There's electronics involved, with the transmitter, and it's actually four channel radio. So it has the rudder, the elevator. You know, you have to learn the actual flight terms to learn, one, to learn how to build it, but also to learn how to fly it. So it has a rudder and an elevator, and it has ailerons and flaps. So you really, it's not something that you can just build and go out and fly. You, in order to actually learn how to fly one of these, you have to either work with an instructor that teaches you how to do it, or take a course. You can't just build it and go out and fly it yourself. There's not without, crashing it or hurting somebody. So it's pretty advanced. It can fly, the range is probably not quite half a mile, so it could fly, out of a normal person's sight if you let it. You have to keep it within range, but it'll fly real high. It can fly 400 or 500 feet up in the air. You have to learn how to land it. You have to be able to deal with it. It's interesting. It's a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun working on that, and I had a lot of fun working on the vehicles, because the vehicles that I have a lot of the same parts and a lot of the same terminology and stuff as real full-size vehicles do. They're also radio controlled. They're not attached to anything. They have an engine that runs on a mixed nitro methanol fuel. They have a full transmission, a two-speed transmission. They have disc brakes. They have a suspension. Drive shafts. I mean, it's a very complex piece of machinery. My wife says it's a toy. I keep telling her it's not a toy. It's a machine. But she disagrees with me. I enjoy mechanical things and gadgets like that.
And why not? Sounds great. I'd love to see one. I've never seen a model like that. I'd really, really love to see one. Maybe I will one of these days. Now, we're talking to each other on For the People, obviously. When did For the People come into your life?
I joined For the People, I believe, in January of this year. And I found out about For the People. I started doing stuff from the... Jaws help list. I was on the Jaws mailing list from Freedom Scientific for the help list, and folks were talking about accessible games. So therefore, I ended up on All in Play, and some folks that I met on All in Play told me about For the People. So I came out here, and I found out that I really, you know, really had a lot of in common with a lot of the folks out here. I made a lot of good friends out here, and have spent quite a bit of time out here. So I really enjoyed it. But it's been about January of this year, I believe.
And what do you find so appealing about the Peeps?
I think that everybody that's on here, you know, everybody's got a story, you know, just like I do. Everybody's got a story. I enjoy meeting and talking to new people. I've always been pretty social, I think. And, you know, I like the people. I like the FTP radio. I like the different subject areas that folks get into. I think it's a great time. I think it's a great way for people to meet new friends and keep up with folks.
And we're sort of coming towards the end of our chat now, Jody, and I'm going to ask you a couple of serious questions and then a bit of frivolity at the very end. What would you say so far in your life has been your greatest achievement?
Probably getting married and having my children. I think that it's like they say, you know, the greatest day of your life is when you get married, and then being in the delivery room when you have your first child and even the second child. There's absolutely nothing in the world that even comes close to comparing to those events.
And what about your philosophy on blindness or disability?
Well, like I say, we kind of touched on that whenever you know, in talking about the interview process. I, growing up, of course, I didn't know any other blind people, none. And in college, I met some through the Disabled Student Services and stuff. And you know, several of the folks that I met just seemed to have this horrible negative attitude about what, you know, about their situation, and just felt like that society owed them something. And I just, that really got me on the wrong side of the fence when it came to even other blind people. And one of the things I like about For the People is that people here don't seem to be that way at all. People are positive. They know, you know, they take care of themselves. You know, I just think that as far as blindness goes, it's your responsibility to take care of yourself. It's your responsibility to get out and be successful and do what you can. And if somebody slams a door in your face, just go find another door to open it, or find a way to open the one that slammed. I mean, it's very important to stay positive and do whatever it takes, you know, to be successful. I mean, that's all there is to it. I think that if you follow that philosophy, you know, you won't run into as many barriers as you would otherwise.
Very, very wise words. Okay, I'm just going to spring this on you. I didn't tell you about this the other day, but here we go. I don't want any thinking time whatsoever. I want the first thing that comes into your head to answer the question. What's your favorite radio station?
My favorite radio station would probably be WRIF here in Detroit, which is a rock station.
My favorite TV program?
I watch football on Sundays. That's an easy one.
Your favorite month of the year?
July or August, either one. I like the summer months.
And finally, your favorite place to go for a break away from everything?
As far as a vacation destination, I would have to say Hawaii. We did go to Hawaii for another friend's wedding, and I would love to go back to Hawaii. I would love it there.
Okay, Jody, thanks very much indeed. That's the end of the formal interview, and we usually invite people to ask questions or make comment if you're prepared to field a few questions from the room. But on behalf of myself and on behalf of all the people in the room, can I thank you for a really, really interesting interview. It's been a great pleasure to speak to you, and we'd never spoken until the other day, had we? But I feel that we're old friends now, and it's a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks, Jody.
Well, thank you much, Steve. Yeah, we hadn't got a chance to meet. I'd always heard a lot of folks you know, mention your name and always say good things about you. And you know, since from our pre-interview all the way through today, it's really been enjoyable. And you know, this wasn't as difficult as I thought it was going to be. It was a lot of fun.
FTP Radio.
What's my favorite FTP radio show?
No, I would have said FTP Radio for the radio station.
Well, I enjoy FTP Radio as well. As far as FTP Radio, I get in when I can. It's hard because, you know, with the little ones running around, because that's prime time for them. But I usually try to catch the rock shop. That's definitely up my alley. I like country and stuff as well, but probably the rock shop, because of the stuff that Joe plays from the 80s, is directly in the era that I grew up and that I enjoyed. So that's got to be my favorite.
Okay, any questions for Jody?
I just want to thank both of you again. It was a great interview. And I want to thank Jody for making such a wonderful contribution to the site with his tech support, and personally for the tech support you've given Blaine and I. But great to have you with us on For the People, Jody. And as always, great interview, Steve.
Thanks, Jennifer. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm glad I caught this. Dealing with some of these big corporations, oh man, you still have to, even though you said you didn't like math that well, you must be pretty good at it, because with all the programming and stuff you have to do, it seems to me that your math skills would have to be almost top notch.
Well, the thing that I found, especially working with business applications, if I was working for NASA or somebody like that, or I was trying to develop space shuttle programs, it'd be one thing. But I work in the business environment, and the business area doesn't have to be that complex. And as far as writing computer programs, it's a lot more logic than it is math. You have to be able to think logically, step by step, and what needs to happen, what needs to come first. Logic is a lot more important than math is when it comes to computer programming, as far as I'm concerned.
Hi, Judy. I'm Shiv. I'm from Bombay, India. I missed the initial part of the interview, but I joined in when you mentioned that you have some colleagues working in Bombay. I would just like to know what sort of work you do.
Like I say, I'm a computer database administrator. I have computer programmers for EDS, for Electronic Data Systems, working there in Mumbai.
Hi, Jody. This is Lana. What made you so positive, do you think? What helped you become so positive about life and your attitude towards it?
Probably my parents and my grandparents both had a big influence on that. I think that as a younger child, if I ever, complained about something that I couldn't do or whatever, I think that my father especially, you know, rather than just hold my hand or doing it for me, they would say, well, you know, you're just going to have to figure out another way to do it, you know. And my mom was pretty innovative in coming up with things like that. You know, there wasn't books or research materials to teach my mom, you know, how to know that, okay, well, if we take your clothes and we organize them like this, then you'll know where things are or whatnot, you know. Just kind of innovative things. I think my parents and my grandparents were both very helpful in that, and I think that if you don't have someone holding your hand all the way through your life, you know, you tend to, you know, once you learn how to do something yourself, it makes you be more positive because you can say, hey, I can do that, you know, I can accomplish these things. I may not do it the same way somebody else does, but I can get it done.
Hey, I just want to take a second to say I really enjoyed your interview. So this is Golden Heart here, and I really enjoyed everything. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, Jody. Did great. And Steve as well. Thanks a lot.
Jody, I have a question about the research you're involved in. When the doctor did the screening on your family and found that you're a perfect candidate for the research. Did they find other candidates to research, or did they publish findings based on one family, yours?
No, there are other test cases, although Lieber's in itself is fairly rare. It's not a it's not like RP or glaucoma or something like that. It's not as common. So they definitely did have other research families. We weren't the only one. But you know, our family made a much better test case because we had siblings who did not have the condition as well. So we were 100% right what they were looking for when it came to that. So that's kind of where that came from. You kind of find things to do. One of the things that didn't come up in the interview that whenever I was in high school, because I couldn't participate in basketball or baseball or whatever, there was a karate school that opened up in town. Had an instructor, actually was a teacher at the school, and also opened up a karate studio, actually a taekwondo studio. And I asked my parents, you know, can I get involved in that, you know, so I could probably learn how to, you know, learn that. And they said, sure, well, you could try it, you know. And I ended up studying taekwondo for about 4.5 years, and really, you know, got into that. I actually instructed, taught the young kids class for a while, and I think that also helped me be real positive, because of the traditional teachings in taekwondo have a lot based on self-confidence and integrity and things like that. I think that really helped me too, and it also gave me a sense of accomplishment, because that was something that I could do where some of the other kids were playing baseball or basketball, and that gave me an outlet for, you know, something that's physical but also something that I could do.
Okay, any more actual questions for Jody? I'm thinking of the recorders, if they're still recording. So any more actual questions for Jody, and then we can have a suitable ending. No, looks as if that's it. Thanks once again, Jody, and great chatting to you. And please feel free just to stay and chat.
All right, thanks again, Steve. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.